Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Yes, it is.
This week, we will be talking about a book.
An old book?
Yes.
Is it gonna be Teddy Ruxpin?
No, even older.
Oh boy.
It is from the 19th century, because books were to the 19th century what YouTube tutorials are to the new millennium.
What, inane?
Yes, but also, according to the Victorians, there's nothing you can't learn from a book.
Oh, I can think of a couple of things.
Such as housekeeping, general surgery,
decorative
electricity with a chapter on fire risks.
That's true. That one's true.
And how to ride a horse.
Yeah, huh? From a book?
From a book.
From a book.
There's no way this can go wrong.
No, this is all coming up horseback.
Without further ado, we give you Horse and Man by Charles Spencer March Phillips, published 1869.
They just don't make names as long as they used to.
Now you may be asking yourself, why does this book exist?
Well, because I need to learn how to ride a horse, but I don't have a horse.
Correct.
Which that does beg the question, why do I need to learn to ride a horse? It seems I'm not in possession of a horse.
Well, prior to the 19th century, horses were engines.
No, they're animals, Ken.
Yes, but rather than the mechanical engine of the industrial era, we had the meat engine of the horse.
How many horsepower is it?
Exactly.
How many horsepower is a horse?
It is one. Unless it is in a team with its best friend, at which point it becomes exponentially more powerful.
I see.
For more information, see my brother and me. However, so prior to the 19th century, the laboring classes work with horses a lot. For farming, obvi. Horses pull plows. Horses pull wagons. Horses pull basically anything what needs pulling, up to and including mining carts.
That doesn't seem like a great idea for the horse.
I mean, mining's not really a great idea for anybody, but here we are. And horses are also how you travel any distance that cannot be walked. To be fair, people were more accustomed to walking long distances back in the day. But
I was going to say, I have reliable authority that you could walk 500 miles and then you could also walk 500 more.
Those,
at the minimum.
Those require special circumstances.
I see.
Up to and including extreme devotion to one particular person for whom you would walk 1,000 miles and then fall down at their door.
Or perhaps one particular horse.
Yes. But then, as I cleverly foreshadowed 3 seconds ago, the Industrial Revolution happened.
No more horse. Horse time is over. Take that, you smug equines.
Okay, so we still had horses.
Oh.
They just filled a different role in society and were used by different people.
I apologize, horses. Please do not eat my hair in the night.
They're gonna. I'm sorry, but they've already put that in the calendar. So the steam engine takes most horse jobs.
Right. Not Delight and Grace.
I mean...
No, stop.
Do we want to have, like... a train detour on this episode
we're gonna talk about the horses.
About the divine beauty of a smoothly running steam engine.
Yeah, nope, that's creepy. Let's go back to the horse.
So, steam engine, in form of train, now pulls big loads much further and faster than horse ever could.
Mm-hmm.
It also does a lot of the farming tasks, such as threshing and reaping and sowing.
Right.
Tractoring. All that good shit.
Spinning Jenny.
Yes.
The one machine I know.
The spinning Jenny is not typically used for farming.
I don't know what a spinning Jenny is. I'm just going to admit that I've said the word spinning Jenny at least 3 times in my life without ever knowing what it does.
So quick sidebar. The spinning Jenny is what came after the spinning mule. The spinning mule is so named is because it was the mechanical replacement for hand spinning.
Oh, okay, so it's like a spinning thing.
Yes. Spinning mule because it worked as hard as a mule.
Spinning because it spins.
Yes. And then spinning Jenny because the Jenny is the word for a female mule.
Okay. All right.
And I guess model 2.0 defaults to female?
Yeah.
Although I guess if we're going like the biblical route.
No.
First human dude, second human lady. So that does track.
I guess for a certain value of tracking, it does.
Do you want to hear more about trains?
Tell me about the horses.
So, because the steam engine is taking most of the horse jobs and most of the human jobs, humans move into the cities to forestall starvation, to work in the factories that now use machines such as spinning jennies and spinning mules.
Now, I don't like how you've sandwiched the words starving and horse together.
I mean, you know. But by moving to the city away from the countryside, and by horses no longer being involved so much in work, the working class kind of loses their connection to horses.
That's so sad.
Horse jobs still exist, but are no longer a given. They're usually defaulting to transportation in any place where trains can't reach.
Right.
Which is fewer and fewer places every year. Because nothing can stop the beauty and majesty of the train.
A boiler explosion can.
Is that not in its own way majestic?
If you think a bunch of dead clowns are majestic, then I guess yes.
I mean, the fans of It would agree.
That clown is alive.
Wait, fuck, seriously?
Well, spoilers for It, but it's complicated.
So some workers thrive in this new, less horse, more smog environment.
Okay.
They and their progeny rise up to form the new middle class as clerks and engineers and etc.
And they'll go on to ruin everything.
So suddenly you have city folk who are born into poverty with no experience riding horses, who, as adults, can afford to ride horses for pleasure, as the aristocratic class has been doing for centuries.
Okay.
And for them, this book is written.
Oh, because they never had a horse, but they want to ride a horse.
Exactly.
All right, there
they
it is.
They never had any exposure to a horse as a kid, except for the thing you have to get out of the way of in the street. But now, as an adult, they have money to burn, and they're like, hey, I want the class symbols that the upper classes have. Instead of, you know, Michael Kors, they have thoroughbreds.
Wow.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, a little, but go on.
So, Horse and Man by Charles Spencer March Phillips. Who the fuck is Charles Spencer March Phillips?
A fine question.
It is difficult to say.
Well, I think one thing we could say is that a man who wrote a book.
150 years of near total indifference has rendered him essentially anonymous.
That's, I think, a crime that you would say anything like indifference to this bold, brave man who is willing to show me, when no one else would, how to ride a horse.
But I did find more information about him in two places on the entire internet.
Horsewiki.com.
No. Ancestry.com.
All right, well, you'll forgive my immediate skepticism.
According to them, he was born on February 28th, 1815, in Camden, Middlesex, England. Two parents, Samuel March Phillips and Charity Amelia Grant. He had six kids, and then he died on September 26, 1869, in Tiverton, Devon, England. And if you're asking yourself, wait, he died the same year his book came out? Yes.
That is normal, I think.
He published the book in February of that year and died in September.
I think the book was an act of crucifixion.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
And I will not elaborate or apologize. I'll do neither of those things for what I've just said.
The second place I found this man was in A Critical Dictionary of English Literature and British and American Authors Living and Deceased from the Earliest Accounts to the Latter Half of the 19th Century, Volume 2, published by J.B. Lippincott and Company in 1878.
What a thrilling volume.
I know.
Two.
According to them, our boy Charles wrote two entire books.
Well, okay, did he die after the second one?
Yes.
So that's a given at this point.
D, the alternative is that he died after the first one.
Yes.
And before the second one.
Yes. Or that he never died at all. There are two alternatives. He walks among us. He did come back briefly to finish his horse book.
Inside you, there are two wolves. One died before finishing the second book, and the other one never died.
Yeah. The one that lives is obviously the one that never died. I don't know why you were asking.
His first book was called Jurisprudence in 1863, and near as I can tell, it is literally just a whole book on the concept of jurisprudence.
That is a really good use of your time, my man.
It was reviewed by the London Reader.
Of course it was.
Quote, cannot honestly be said to deserve high commendation.
And there it is. The measure of a man who would die writing his second book.
His second book, Horse and Man. And that is literally everything we know about him.
You know, not everyone can be a hero.
He certainly didn't live long enough to see himself become the villain.
Oh, did he? I think we should review the contents of this horse book and find out.
Let's go to Horseland.
Yeah.
Behold the introduction, and yes, this is literally the first sentence.
Wonderful.
The principal object of this little work is to make the English sportsman acquainted with the rudiments of M. Boucher's admirable system of suppling the horse.
Oh, I don't like that word. Let's take that one right up. First edit.
Uh-huh.
Not that one. Wrong.
You don't like the word suppling?
No, please stop.
You are going to hate this book.
All right, next sentence.
Well, already we need to slam on the brakes because who is M. Boucher?
I guess someone who already wrote a horse book?
Correct! It is actually François Boucher, with M being short for Monsieur. Born 1796, died 1873, and according to Wikipedia, he is a French riding master whose methods are still debated by dressage enthusiasts today.
Huh, a controversial figure.
Oh, yes. Basically, he came up with the idea of telling a horse to stop by using both your hands and your legs.
I don't understand the issue.
The problem is, if hand means stop and leg also means stop, there are no limbs left to single go.
But.
Your butt cannot tell a horse to go. I'm sorry.
Mouth.
Please do not.
Use your mouth to supple the horse,
please. Do not use mouth on horse.
Use, this is a really bad point and click adventure.
Yeah, it is, my dude.
I don't like it at all.
Escape.
Z.
Use match on book.
Obvious exits are north, south, and horse.
But then, according to Wikipedia, Boucher was severely injured during midlife when a large chandelier fell on him while preparing one of his horses for exhibition.
You know, that is not how I would have expected a horseman to be injured.
So I'm assuming he was working with the horse in the Phantom of the Opera's cave.
I'm trying to imagine what it feels like to be a man who works with, like, horses, and then a fucking chandelier falls on you. And you are working on the horse, so the option was still there. It's like a Looney Tunes bit. Like, he lights the stick of dynamite, and it fizzles out, and then an anvil comes on him from above.
So, after that, Boucher changed his whole method so hand and leg are totally separate in what signals they have.
That's good.
So the TLDR of it is he turned equestrian Europe upside down in the 19th century.
By making a bad choice and then saying, my bad, after he got hit with a chandelier.
After the chandelier corrected his method, yes.
Well, here's the thing. I don't understand why the chandelier was the crux, but that's fine. We all get to where we're going in different ways.
Listen. Back to horse and man. Our boy Charles wants to bring Boucher's horse stylings to England.
The good one? The post, pre, or post chandelier stylings?
Post chandelier.
Right.
35 years after Boucher's own publication. Why hasn't Boucher's method caught on in the UK?
No one can read French.
Charles has some ideas. Quote, like many men of original genius, Boucher was far more successful in discovering truth than in explaining it.
Whoa. Shade.
Indeed, there are certain portions of his teaching whose precise object and connection I frankly acknowledge myself unable to comprehend.
What a genius. I have no idea what he's saying.
Nor is this all. He perpetually employs that particular tone of philosophical grandiloquence which is so dear to French writers and so utterly intolerable to English readers.
Well, you know what, my man? Yeah.
Here's the thing. I don't think anyone who writes like that is allowed to say anyone else is writing with philosophical grandiloquence that is intolerable.
That's true.
At a certain point when that's your vocabulary, you need to take a step back and look in a mirror for a couple minutes.
And see a horse.
Oh god. The horse of the invisible comes for us all. Charles continues. I have therefore endeavored to explain them in a simple and straightforward manner.
All right, Charles, let's take four hooves all the way back.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what he was saying. I'm going to explain it to you.
And more simply.
I'm going to simplify this thing. Let me be very clear, I do not understand.
So the problem with the 19th century is that nobody could explain anything simply.
Or at all.
Regardless of language. Charles goes on.
He does.
All Englishmen hate theory. And perhaps no Englishman hates it so thoroughly as an English sportsman.
Okay.
Stephen Hawking would like a word.
That's true.
I have, however, in the present work, attempted something more than this. I must confess that I have never seen any book upon horsemanship which I thought likely to be useful to a beginner.
Yes, because it was a book, Charles.
The modern English manuals, though far more rational and correct, have all one great deficiency. They are invariably written by men who have evidently been practiced horsemen from their childhood.
Yeah, that's the last person I want to what?
How can such a man realize the difficulties of a novice?
He
tells us what we ought to do, but if we were to suggest that we cannot do it, he would listen as if we were complaining that we cannot help stammering or squinting. It is very singular and very unfortunate. He cannot account for it. He has been performing these maneuvers all his life and has never found them puzzling or difficult.
I think the one person I want to explain something to me that I've never done and don't understand is someone who's also never done it and doesn't understand.
I will say I do agree with Charles to a point on this bit, because it's a bit like my uncle, the biomechanical engineer, trying to explain math to me. Like, he went into that field because he understands and enjoys math and finds it as easy as I do art. But because it comes so easily to him, he absolutely cannot explain it to someone to whom it does not come easily.
I feel like there is a middle distance in what we're looking at.
Okay.
Because the other thing is that a book written by me on biomechanics would be useless.
A book written by you on biomechanics after you had successfully learned biomechanics.
Possibly, that's the middle ground. That's yes. The middle ground. I don't believe Charles has successfully done anything.
I think he has. Now, I am well aware that most of these gentlemen know much more of good writing than I do, but I flatter myself that I know much more of bad writing than they do.
Huh.
Circumstances induced me, when in the prime of life, to take pains enough to become a fair mechanical horseman, and the difficulties of the achievement are therefore fresh and vivid in my memory. The method which I have found most effectual for the purpose is a simple adaptation of the system which Monsieur Bachet applies to the education of the horse.
The suppling, if you will?
Sidebar. Belcher's system is intended for teaching horses. Charles wants to apply this same system to teach humans.
Well, if a horse can do it.
So easy a horse can do it. Or, in Charles's own words. In other words, it consists in learning one thing at a time.
No.
Yes. It is, I need scarcely remark, exclusively intended for the use of inexperienced horsemen.
Well, horse says, but sure. You've made your adaptations, Charles.
It cannot change a good rider into a first-rate one, but I believe that, if perseveringly and intelligently practiced, it will enable a bad rider to become a tolerable one.
Everyone's main goal.
I don't need to be the best, I just need to be competent.
Well, the price of a book in the 1800s, I would like you to do a little better than that.
According to Charles, Bocher has written the ideal guide for horsemanship, except for two faults.
It is for horses.
It is written in French.
an unforgivable fault.
And it is written by and for people who already know how horses work.
Right.
Charles has made it his mission to correct these errors. Will he succeed?
No.
Let's find out. Chapter 1. The Seat. Upon no subject has more consummate nonsense been talked or written than upon the best method of acquiring a good seat on horseback.
You put your butt.
Oh, fool.
Now what does Charles think I should be doing?
Charles takes particular umbrage with the vulgar opinion that no man can become a horseman who has not been used to riding from his childhood.
All right, well, I agree with him there.
Charles, unlike most 19th century authors, doesn't believe the lower classes are too stupid to pick up new skills. In fact, we are told that shopmen and mechanics, when settled upon an Australian or Californian cattle farm, soon learn to imitate the gymnastic feats of the stockmen and vaqueros around them. And we know that if 100 clerks or apprentices are enlisted in a dragoon regiment, 99 of them will in 6 months sit their horses quite as firmly as an ordinary groom or postboy.
All right, that's grim, but sure.
6 months, you say?
Yeah.
Charles claims that in 1 month he can get a clerk on a horse, and in 3 months he can have him riding as well as an aristocrat born into the saddle.
I thought he said he was going to have me riding better than shitty.
I don't know that he promised that.
I don't know, that just seems like high praise for a man who earlier said, you don't have to learn to be good, you just have to learn to be less bad.
Exactly. You're already shitty. He will elevate you to mediocre.
Is he calling all the aristocrats mediocre?
Mediocre. Bold words, Charles. How, may it be asked, is this thing to be done? I answer simply by attending to one thing at a time.
Again, huh?
It's his version of the secret.
It's not bad advice.
You want to sit on a horse, says Charles?
I do.
Good. Do that.
I'm so glad I bought your book, Charles.
And only that! Get somebody else to hold the reins while you concentrate on learning to sit.
Charles, I learned that a long time ago. I need to learn to...
Only when you have mastered sitting do you proceed.
Okay, I got it. All right, next, Charles.
In his own words, you have only to take a lesson in an ordinary riding school to learn how necessary this advice unfortunately is. Your instructor first screws you by main force into what is to you a most unnatural position.
Ain't that true?
And next gives you certain instructions which you cannot understand. In this state of bodily and mental discomfiture, you walk twice or thrice round the school, and then your troubles begin. Trot, steady, Mr. So-and-so, keep him in hand, don't let him canter, guide him into the corners, a little faster, press him with the legs, touch him with the whip. Too fast, pull him up, halt, halt, halt! Never mind, sir, mount him again, you will soon catch the knack of it. And so no doubt you would if you were allowed to catch one knack at a time, but a half dozen simultaneous catches are too much for human dexterity.
Fair.
They're not too much for Drizzt Do'Urden's dexterity, but we digress.
He's an elf.
He is drow.
They are elf.
Charles doesn't want to teach you to ride that way.
I can see that, yeah.
Charles wants to teach you one step at a time.
Yeah, I know. He wants me to sit on the horse and, I don't know, dissociate.
Step one, get on horse.
Step two, dissociate.
You are probably acquainted with the ordinary method of mounting and dismounting, and if you are not, you can easily find it out for yourself.
Thanks, Charles, you dumb fuck!
So, reminder, this book is explicitly for people who know nothing about horses.
Listen, the problem with other people's books is that they don't start at the beginning. Get on the horse, I don't fucking care how you do it. Figure it out. I'm so glad I spent money on your book, Charles.
But Charles has already moved on to posture.
No, that's great, thanks, Charles. No, I didn't need to know that. I bought your absolute beginner's guide so you could skim over the first part. No, thank you. No, thank you.
Good Charles always helps. It is commonly said that the best and firmest position on horseback is the most natural. And this is in one sense perfectly true. But the word natural is often loosely used, and therefore easily misunderstood.
You are overcomplicating this, Charles. What is your point?
I do think he has a good point about the word natural being used to the point where it loses all meaning.
Well, yes, but you're saying that in the year 2020. I don't think it had, I think he might be, he's putting me on a little, I think.
So, are you saying that I am speaking with 2020 hindsight?
I think, yeah. 2020 vision.
The best and firmest position on horseback is undoubtedly that which is natural to the human frame, when in its proper state. And therefore that which ought to be natural to every human being.
Which is what, Charles?
But we know too well that the frame of an ordinary human being is by no means in its proper state, and will often be unpleasantly strained and wearied by a position which would be perfectly natural to a well-trained athlete. And it is therefore probable that an ordinary human being may require some instruction before he can assume, and some gymnastic discipline before he can comfortably retain, the position on horseback which experience shows to be the most secure, and which an accomplished horseman would no doubt pronounce to be the most natural.
Stop telling me what I should know, Charles!
But what is the best position on horseback?
Oh my god, he had no idea what he was gonna write. That's like fucking two pages of filler. Very presumptuous for a book that started with like, no one else starts from the beginning. Here's what if you were good at this, you would know. Let me tell you about the right way to do it. It's correct. And if you knew what you were doing, you'd do it. But you don't.
Or if you'd wait 5 seconds, we'd get into what the best position looks like.
Oh, finally. Please tell me, Charles.
The horseman's fork. That is to say, the space between his thighs must rest upon the center of the saddle and support the full weight of his body. Put all your weight on your dick.
Excellent. Good advice. Immediately, Charles. Immediately. Yeah. Well, that answers the question about what to do if you're telling the horse no with your arms and legs.
Please do not tell your horse yes with your dick. Please.
Really earning that explicit rating today, boy.
The necessary consequences will be that the flat or inner surface of his thighs will lie along the saddle flaps, that his spine will be hollow or concave at the waist, that his chest will expand itself, that his shoulders will fall back, and that his head will stand erect upon his neck.
His dick will be mashed potato.
The arms and hands in the absence of reins, and the legs and feet in the absence of stirrups, may be suffered to hang down in the postures assigned by their weight.
What a beautiful image.
Put all of your weight on your dick and then go ragdoll.
Just ragdoll on this horse. It's the best way to sit, I promise.
According to Charles, this is harder than it sounds.
You know what? I'm just gonna leave that right where it is.
Now, this position may be perfectly natural to a strong, well-made young man, thoroughly inured to athletic exercise. But it will prove exceedingly irksome to a middle-aged gentleman of sedentary habits, long accustomed to divide his existence between lying in a bed, stooping over a desk, lounging in a chair, and plodding along a pavement.
It's like, don't need you judging me like this, Charles.
The position which such a person will find the most easy and comfortable when first placed on horseback will be very different from that just described. He will probably rest his weight upon his seat behind the thighs, with his back curved, his shoulders drooping forward, his knees elevated, and his feet advanced. And, if induced by his instructor to assume a better attitude, he will go home with his spine and thigh joints aching as if dislocated, and with his mouth full of indignation at the pedantry which forbids him to use his limbs and muscles in the manner designed by Providence.
Right.
Remember when he said he was going to simplify it?
Yeah, I remember that. About 6 pages ago.
In conclusion, capitalism has been destroying the human body since the mid-19th century.
And don't sit on the horse with your ass, apparently.
No.
Rookie mistake.
Charles continues.
I'm sure he does.
The mistake made by such a pupil is easily explained. He objects to the position on horseback which he is required to assume because, whatever may be its other advantages, it is painful and fatiguing.
Imagine.
How can he possibly tell at present whether it is necessarily fatiguing or not?
What?
Sure, you feel tired, but are you really?
Yes. Charles?
He has all his life been standing and walking with his backbone convex and rigid, and it is no wonder that he now feels uneasy when it becomes concave and supple.
Don't. All right, there it is again, Charles. I don't want to. We talked about this word.
If he had been hopping all his life upon one leg, he would have felt uneasy when he began to stand or walk upon two.
No.
Before he can judge whether the upright or the stooping position on horseback is really the easiest, that is to say, which of the two is capable of being longest maintained without fatigue, he must first become equally familiar with both.
All right.
But how?
Do it.
The end.
Well, I'm sure Charles has a lot to say on the subject.
Begin by using the ordinary gymnastic means for suppling the shoulders. Stop. And loins.
All right, no, no, Charles, you're not suppling my loins. Get out. Get out of my house.
Stand erect and work the hips laterally at every possible angle.
What?
Permitting the bust to fall loosely in whatever direction its weight may draw it.
Is he telling them to pelvic thrust while ragdolling?
Yes. He is telling you to bring it around town and let your upper half just do whatever.
Sure.
To supple it.
No, I will not be doing that, Charles. We will not be suppling it.
Stretch and exercise the muscles of the chest and shoulders by using the clubs or dumbbells, or by practicing the military extension motions.
Which is something I guess everyone knows.
Apparently, because Charles doesn't explain it.
You know, I think the problem with other authors is that they assume you know everything. Here's my book. Would you do the military extension maneuver, please? I will not elaborate.
Then get back on that horse.
Sit on your dick.
You will immediately become aware that you have taken a considerable step in advance. The flexure of the loins, which is necessary to combine the proper positions of fork and bust, is no longer irksome.
Charles, I'm not going to keep hiring you if you keep talking about my loins.
In other words, you have no longer any physical uneasiness in sitting your horse as you ought.
No, just psychological uneasiness of being near you.
But, above all things, do not permit yourself to shirk this preliminary difficulty.
All right, I'll sit on my dick, Charles. You got it.
It is this position, correctly taken and skillfully kept, which gives fine riders that peculiar air commonly described as forming part of the horse.
No.
If your loins are supple enough, you will meld into your horse.
No, I don't want to, Charles, thank you. Me and the horse will stay separate. We talked about it.
In fact, nothing is more curious than to watch how the trunk of a skillful but slovenly horseman appears to grow out of his horse's back, while his legs are working and swaying like mere appendages.
I don't like that. I don't like that. I don't like it at all.
No?
Charles, please stop writing. Oh, I think I know why he died by the end of this.
Congrats. Now you know how to assume your pose.
Thank you.
But can you maintain it?
No, I'm just swinging around like a fucking idiot.
Here's how you learn how to maintain it. Step 1. Have your horse led about at a walk.
Alright.
Step 2. Throw yourself into every irregular attitude you can think of.
I mean, that's my day-to-day, so I've got it, yeah.
Sit on your dick and do go ragdoll.
Just flaw. That's gonna, like, it's supposed to be a really good day for the horse.
Swing your body backwards and forwards. Shift your seat from side to side, sway and stretch your thighs and legs, and return after every change of posture to your original position.
Guaranteed, do not fucking weird your horse out at all.
When you can do this with a single, quick, smooth, easy movement,
no,
you know how to take a good seat on horseback.
Thrash on the horse in one quick, easy movement.
Get on a horse and then just do a dead drop straight onto your own dick.
And from there, I'm going to need you to flail like a dying cod on a boat.
It's a baby wheel.
While repeatedly returning to pinion on your dick.
And now, the legs.
I don't want to get to the legs, Charles. You already told me to do several very dangerous things.
Because getting on is one thing and staying on is another.
Well, you told me to let my, to ragdoll my legs and then flop them all which way about.
Yeah.
Is that how I stay on?
Horses love when you do that.
Do horses love when you do things that are erratic?
And unpredictable, and directly on top of them, and sudden.
It's really, I think, the horse's number one.
Yeah. Horses love surprises. That's what they don't tell you in most equestrian schools.
Yeah, like, everyone has a hard time with horses because no one's learned the secret, which is to sneak up behind them, preferably, like, below tail level, and just slap them hard on the ass.
That's how you befriend a horse.
It is, how you supple him.
I learned it from Barbie Riding Club.
Yes. That's fake. Barbie Riding Club told you that if you feed a horse carrots exactly 3 times, it's your friend. And that's actually pretty close to reality.
Barbie Riding Club taught me how to psychically communicate horse locations with my friends.
And you use that every day now. So I do. I don't know what you're complaining about.
Why do you think I'm so good at graphic design?
Yeah, because you always know where your horse is.
And can telepathically clue my friends into the horse's existence and precise location.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times a day if I'm driving past where you work. I kind of just know where your horse is.
Mm-hmm. But returning to Charles. If you wish to keep your seat in an unexpected shock, you have only one course to pursue.
Throw yourself off.
You must acquire the knack of firmly grasping your saddle with your legs. Nothing else will do.
I don't think I needed that much pageantry for him to tell me that part.
What, then, ought to be your first step?
Put the leg on the horse.
Look at a cook made skinning eels.
Yeah, of course. I've got 6 of those.
She knows that the strongest man in England could not effectually grasp an eel with a slippery hand, and therefore she commences operations by carefully sanding her fingers.
Oh, Charles, is this going to end with you telling me to be sure I'm wearing pants?
You know, or if you choose to try, you will soon find out, that the strongest pair of legs cannot, if clad in cloth overalls, effectually grasp a leather saddle.
He's going to tell me how to wear pants, yeah.
Begin, therefore, by clothing your legs in leather.
Right, yeah, no, alright, yeah. Don't ride the horse naked. I got it.
Then it's just a matter of thigh mastering your horse.
Just squeeze that bitch.
Practice.
Yeah.
Take your gripe deliberately and then try its strength by abandoning your balance.
Just fall off the horse. Hey, the best way to stay on your horse is to purposefully fall off your horse.
Is to try as hard as you can to fall off the horse.
And here's the thing, if you're not good at horseback riding and you purposely try to fall off your horse, the good news is you're going to be really good at it.
Throw your body backwards. Or sway it from side to side and watch how heavy a strain the tenacity of your thighs and legs is able to support without slipping.
I don't know.
Which is worse? Tenacious thighs or supple loins?
Supple loins.
Okay.
But I don't... This motherfucker... Did he teach his kid to walk by, like throwing it?
I mean, he had 6 of them to experiment on, so like, probably.
Like, here's the thing. What I'm going to do is everything physically that is antithetical to walking. And then you'll realize that walking is better than falling.
Well, isn't there that, like, developmental stage where kids like being thrown around because it helps them figure out their body's relation to gravity?
Yeah, that's true. But, like, it's not for the reasons Charles is positing here.
No, I'm pretty sure it is.
About how I should unseat myself violently so that I know how to do it right.
Yeah. Practice makes perfect.
No.
Next, sit loosely, let your body fall backwards or sideways, and stop its fall by catching the saddle with your legs.
Right.
You practice not falling by trying as hard as you can to fall and then not falling.
He does. All right, so there's merit to the idea of learning through failure, but did anyone teach him that you don't have to fail on purpose?
Perhaps he is one of those people who has never failed except on purpose.
Well, he failed at staying alive after publishing this book.
Jesus
so.
Christy!
I'm just saying, he failed one major step.
I still have no idea how he died. There was no information on that.
I think it was probably a chandelier accident at the barn. Takes all the best horsemen from us. Where would he have a horse where there was also a chandelier big enough to kill him?
Any Victorian hippodrome?
That's a good point.
Although, being as he was a Frenchman, I feel like the Phantom of the Opera Theater is always an option.
I don't think you get a horse in there.
The Phantom has one in his cave.
That's a good point. That's it. I don't have anything else to say other than yeah. Don't look at me like that, I admit it.
Part 3. Suppling the waist.
Ah, suppling another body part. I put on my pants, now I have to supple my waist.
You've put on your leather pants yes. after suppling your loins.
I am Draco in leather pants now.
Yes. Now we need to combine good posture with the thigh master grip.
Great, I've fallen off my horse roughly 30 times.
It may be tempting to sacrifice your hard-won good posture upon the altar of thigh master grip.
It might be.
But, Charles says, this temptation you must resolutely and successfully resist.
I'll try not to fall off my horse.
Because, according to Charles, there is no human with thighs strong enough to stay on a horse if their spine is stiff.
Okay.
Stiff spine gets you thrown out of the saddle.
I think the Rock could do it, but what do you know, Charles?
Tragically, we do not have time for all 7 chapters of Horse and Man. But hopefully you've learned something about acquiring and keeping your seat in the saddle.
But Ken, can we come back to Horse and Man? I have so much to learn.
You're not sick of hearing about suppling your loins yet?
No, I need to know what other parts of me is supple. How many times do I throw myself off this fucking horse before I get it?
Well, I will leave you with this tantalizing tidbit. The old-fashioned military and the old-fashioned hunting seats were both, in my opinion, more or less mistakes.
And there it is. Take that, the military.
So, Dee, do you feel prepared to jump on a horse?
Yeah, it's great because apparently the best thing I can do to learn is to fall immediately right back off.
There we go. That's the spirit.
In fact, it seems to me that it's a mistake if I stay on the horse for pretty much any period of time.
Sources for this episode include...
Horse.
Horse and Man by Charles Spencer March Phillips, published 1869.
I wouldn't have seen that coming.
If you want a 19th century edition, I have no idea how much it will cost you because I couldn't find one. If you want a leather-bound print-on-demand version from Abe Books, you can get one for $44.17.
No shit, really? That cheap?
Yeah. Or you can go on archive.org and get a digital file in almost any format for free.
Oh, gee, I wonder which one I'm going to go with.
Archive.org.
I'm getting the leather-bound.
Please donate.
It's the only one that will stay on the horse.
Oh shit, good point.
All right, so wait, I want to make sure. All right, so you've read this book.
Uh-huh.
Did I get it right? I'm going to put on pants.
Yes.
Not naked.
Right.
I'm going to fall off the horse.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to get back on the horse.
Yep.
I'm going to throw myself violently off the horse.
Correct.
All right, I got it, right?
Yeah, no, you got it. You basically know how to ride a horse now.
I'm going right to the stables.
But yeah, that's Horse and Man.
I love it. I want more. Can we have more?
Only if this episode gets enough downloads.
So you heard that. I'm going to need everyone who's listened to this episode to download it at least 10 times.
Or tell 10 friends.
Or, oh, that's, you know what? That's way better. Tell people.
If you have any horseback riding tips you'd like to share with us, you can email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com. Or hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks and join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends.
If you want to hear more of this book very specifically, or anything else, consider scrolling on down to your podcast app and giving us 5 stars and saying, more horse, please. Or anything. You could say anything, but I would really like to see at least one review that just says more horse.
Some reviews we've received recently include, Antiques Roadshow is so yesterday, by Faye C. I came for the antiques, I stayed for the biting wit and historical pageantry. You will walk away knowing something you didn't know before, and it will be awesome. Thanks, Faye.
Thank you.
And one more from Zesty Lemon Tree.
Thank you, Zesties.
As a big gay 20-something who loves antiques, I got really tired of all my antiques-related media being written, read, and performed very dryly by old, rich, straight people.
Hey, that's why I got into antiques in general.
The first episode I had the pleasure of listening to was the Christie's Histories, Christeries episode, and if you're looking for a great place to start listening, I suggest there.
Thank you.
I guess it's weird for me to say that one at the end of an episode you've already listened to, but just in case, consider listening to a second episode.
Well, you know, if this was the first episode and you were like, dumb show, try that one, maybe you'll like it.
If you would like to purchase some vintage goods, you can check out our Etsy at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks. I swear to God, razor blades.
I swear to God, they're coming. Every time I try to put it on Etsy, I cut myself.
Dino. Are you just grabbing the razor blades and just, like, pressing them against your computer?
Yeah, they won't get in!
If you would like to listen to deleted scenes, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks, where you can also join the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
Like a clock that only chimes once a month.
One of these days we're gonna get it. You know what? One of these days we're gonna figure out what it's like. One of these days we will come up with a simile and or metaphor for the experience of the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, but I would say for now it is rather a lot like receiving a random vintage postcard once per month.
That's a terrible simile, but yeah.
Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes such as Ripper Street Shrieking with Ken.
And which we have to do, please. Give us money so I can get it done.
And thank you in particular for listening.
Especially you.
Goodbye.